everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends, episode 109. So this week on the show, lots to talk about, including Spotify, Universal, the latest research from NPD on music consumption, and much more. But for now, let's start with the introductions. So I'm really pleased to welcome on the show today Nancy Baim, who is Principal Researcher at Microsoft Research. So hi, Nancy, and how's it going today?
Hi, things are going well.
It's great to have you on the show. So you have a really heavy background on academics. So how did you end up at Microsoft?
Well, Microsoft Research is a pretty academic organization. They're all about doing basic research. And I came and I spent some time here as a visitor and awesome. Was easily persuaded that this was the best place for me to pursue my academic agenda.
That's great. Cool. And we have Eamon Ford as well on the show, who's a freelance journalist based in the UK and working for a variety of publications. So hi, Eamon, and how's it going today?
It's going very well, yes. I'm kind of halfway through my day. You guys are just starting your day. But it doesn't get any better, that's what I can say.
I know. I think it's my earliest podcast recording. It's 6 a.m. for me, so...
Ouch. My sympathies.
It's not too bad. It's not too bad. All right. So I think today I wanted to start. There were lots of news this week about... And feel free to interject with any of your viewpoints, because I know that, Nancy, you have very interesting thoughts on fandom and all that side of things on the academic side. So feel free to interject at any point. I wanted to start with Spotify, just because there were so many news on Spotify this week, and starting with a rumored $100 million round, which is going to be potentially announced in January. This apparently is going to be led again by Goldman Sachs, plus a number of other investors, of course. So Spotify is kind of in a really interesting position right now, because the company's valuation is still really high. It's valued at about $3.25 billion. The company keeps adding subscribers. It's got about 15 million subscribers, 15 million users. Yeah, and the latest numbers were 15 million active users and 4 million paying subscribers. And it's launching in more countries. It's adding Ireland and Luxembourg. That was announced this week. So what I wanted to ask you guys is what do you think is Spotify's curve at this point? I mean, there's a lot of talk about profitability and rates and the way that, and also another milestone that was announced is that they might actually end up turning around $500 million worth of income by January 2013 for the year, which is a huge amount. It's $500 million, which is really a lot for one company working in the music space in streaming. So what I want to ask you guys, first of all, do you think Spotify is on the path to profitability, or is the continuous funding, with these huge rounds, just something that is patching a business model that is not quite working yet? Eamon?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question, because obviously Spotify has been burning through cash for 4 years, 5 years now. So, but what it's trying to do in the market, and what other services, audio and Deezer as well, are trying to do is completely change audience behavior. So this is going to take a long time to do, because they don't have the springboard off devices like Apple had. They're creating a whole new sector in the market, so of course they're going to burn through money. Their blessing and curse is that the record companies have an equity stake in them, so all the majors do and the independents do. So that potentially gives them a stay of execution over and above other services. That also allows them to offer the free side. I think what will be the real challenge for Spotify is to properly monetize its ad funded, because that's obviously the hook to get people in to subscribe, but it's also it burns through in royalty payments. So there was an interesting interview with Daniel Ek this week, or last week, I think, where he basically explained why Spotify offices in America are in New York, because it's to be close to Madison Avenue rather than to be close to all the tech people in Silicon Valley. So their play in the States is very clearly a commercial one. So they're building up that side of the business. But that's the bit that needs the most attention, because when you get subscribers, that part of the business probably cleans its own face. But the other part of the business, which is the big lag, which they need to do to get consumers in, the bit that's just blasting through cash at the moment. But if they can properly build up an advertising business, and certainly trend, if you look at the growth of Pandora, and if you look at media spend, particularly in the US and radio, it's diverting from traditional radio onto online. So they're in a very good position to start to scoop up some of that money.
Yeah.
But the question is how long the majors will allow this company to go, and the investors particularly will allow this company to lose money.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Nancy, what's your take on this? Spotify has got the unique position that it can offer a free service as well. So that's really an interesting entry point for the music fans to get into the service.
It is. I think it's a tricky balance for them, the free and the paid and balancing advertising. It's a challenge to figure out how that all works out in a way that people are satisfied with. I agree. It's playing for the long game, and in the short run, it's really hard to know. I think that it's a very disruptive influence in the music industry, and it's part of a broader trend towards streaming, as all the things that we're talking about today speak to, and the growing prominence of streaming radio and streaming listening and mobile listening and listening where you are. So I think that it's going to take a while to play out, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the value systems rejiggered a bit as people try to figure out what's fair and what people are going to be satisfied with.
Yeah, absolutely. And the two juggernauts, of course, are Spotify and Deezer, like we talked about a few weeks ago on the show. And there's a few players that are still sort of waiting in the wings to really make their huge splash into the market. Like, for example, Ardio, because it doesn't have the free play, of course, that limits its user base, but it also limits its spend. So that means that it needs less money to burn, and it can actually concentrate on generating more meaningful revenue out of that.
Interestingly, I was at a talk with Deezer a couple of weeks ago when they announced their funding, and they claimed that the company is profitable. But I guess part of that is because they've got enormous bundled offering deals with France Telecom, so with Orange. Yeah. In France and in the UK, and they're going that way. So you've got a huge audience, so you don't have to spend all that money on recruitment.
Yeah.
So, it was interesting that they claim to be profitable, considering how much focus is on the likes of Spotify burning through cash.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nancy, what do you reckon about? Because I know that in the US, 4G is much more advanced than, in the UK, it's literally just launched. So there were a number of articles in the UK press that were talking about how 4G might be the next stepping stone towards getting more fans to convert to paid subscription services, because, of course, faster access to music, that might help. But in the US, really, we haven't seen almost any tie-ups between telecoms and music services yet. Do you think that's something that's in the works, or do you think there might be fundamental blockers to that becoming a reality?
Well, I mean, not to shill for my own company or anything, but Windows 8 is going to have the Windows 8 phone is going to be integrated with Xbox Music, and that's going to have streaming. So I think that may be a harbinger of things to come, of just having integrated services. I think, certainly in Norway, for example, they've tied in the streaming and the mobile phone industries so tightly that almost everybody is using streaming music services there. They're using WIMP, not Spotify. Well, they use Spotify too, but WIMP especially. So I think it's inevitable that the music delivery mechanisms are going to have to go wherever the people are and whatever the people are using. So I think mobile. That said, 4G is spotty in the States. It's not like, I live in a major metropolitan area, and it comes and goes depending what block I'm on.
Yeah.
So it's not like we've got the halcyon days.
Yeah, absolutely. And
infrastructure still has its limits.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of makes it a little bit easier for companies that have the ecosystem sussed out to work into this space. Because, for example, Google has got the new Google Play matching thing that they've announced. Apple potentially has something in the works in terms of radio streaming. Microsoft has got the music play built into Windows 8. And that makes it a little bit harder for players like Spotify and Ardio and Rhapsody to get into that game, unless they manage to make very strong tie-ups with the telecoms and ISP providers. Do you think that's the case, Eamon?
It puts you in front of a massive audience, but I think even some of those services have or are starting to run into problems because Cricket and Move was being held up certainly by Universal as this kind of groundbreaking model in the States. But then there were some figures recently that model was starting to hit the wall. I think going back to your point about 4G, I think that's going to have an impact on streaming from sites like Vevo and YouTube and Vimeo. I think the whole proposition of the mobile application plays of all of the major streaming services is that you cache stuff on your handset so it doesn't affect your data charges. So yeah. I think it will be kind of more rich media. So it'll be video that will really take off with 4G. I think music, because we've got these caching solutions, and that's the selling point for a lot of people to upgrade and pay the £10 a month or 10 yeah. euros or $10 a month because they can store all the music on the handset. They don't have to go through a music client like iTunes to get music on their phone anymore. They put everything on Wi-Fi, they cache it, and they go about as they commute or whatever, so they don't, it doesn't affect them. But I think mobile will be the big thing. But I think outside of the major markets, I think it will be partnerships in China and India yeah. in the next 5-10 years that will see this massive, massive uptake. I think something like Comes With Music 5 years ago is an interesting model, but they didn't have the handsets. But the rise of really good and cheap, or reasonably cheap, smartphone handsets, so all the HTC models and the kind of increasing ubiquity of Android as well. This is pushing stuff in, certainly in the developed markets, in music's favour. But I think when you take that proposition to China and India, when you've got like literally billions of potential customers, that's when you'll see a proper tipping point. The pricing will have to be dramatically lower, though, yeah. than in Europe and in the US. So yeah. potentially, I don't know, 15-20% of what we're being charged to get uptake. Although I think in India and China, those are some of the only markets that Comes With Music's actually still active in. So it shows mobile there, and certainly it's going to kind of jump, kind of leapfrog over broadband. Most people will be, I think in India, they've got pretty, certainly in the major cities, they've got pretty good mobile connections. So I think that's, if you're talking truly mass audiences, it's going to be in the developing nations and South America, obviously, as well. Yeah. While Spotify has 4 million subscribers, that's like the tiniest sliver of the potential music base you could imagine. So this is still an incredibly niche thing. We can get terribly excited
about
the steps Spotify's making, but you compare that to the number of people who buy CDs or listen to radio, their only penetration is minuscule.
Yeah, yeah. And Nancy, I wanted to bring up a subject that is quite hot in the States still, but it's a worldwide subject really, which is that of net neutrality. And I think it's really important to think about how the access is provided to music and to content on a connection level, because I think like bundling in services, like for example with Microsoft or with Google or with Apple, that is not a problem at all, because people now with apps have access to all sorts of other services. You know, it's not like there's choices restricted in that sense. But what worries me is the idea that, for example, like it happened in Germany with Deutsche Telekom, that if you subscribe to a particular service, then that bandwidth doesn't go towards your bandwidth costs, so that really limits the potential for other services to come in into that particular telecoms market. Because of course, people if they see, okay, so if I stream 2 gigabytes of Spotify or of Deezer or whatever, that doesn't count towards my bandwidth. So of course I'm going to go with them. Do you think that's an issue? Do you think that everybody should be playing on a sort of level playing field on that front?
I would like to see everybody playing on a level playing field. I think as a matter of principle, that's a better way to go. I think that most people in the world don't really want to sit there and figure out which music delivery system is the right one for them. They just want to press a music button and have it work, you know, yeah. And it's geeks like us who really think that having 500 apps to choose from is a good thing rather than an incredible burden.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way it's providing a service to give people one thing that's just there that they can use and it's built in. And on the other hand, of course, in as much as that restricts access to other music and other kinds of listening experiences, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I wanted to move on to talking about a story that involved HP and Universal, and also Windows 8 in a sense, because basically what happened is that Pocket Lint reported that HP and Universal have made a partnership called Music Connected, whereby people are going to be able to stream all of Universal's catalog for a period of 90 days on the purchase of certain Windows 8 HP computers, which is really interesting. I mean, for me, it's not the deal itself that is interesting. It's just the fact that it still shows that there's a huge value placed on music, and there's a lot of companies that are trying to figure out how they can integrate music within their product offering to increase engagement of the people that are buying their products. And the interesting thing about this deal is that there's the music that's involved, but there's also a VIP side of it that actually ends up offering real experiences to people that enter competitions. So you can win tickets to meet Taylor Swift, or go to a gig or whatever. You know, it's kind of it mixes real life experiences with a music service. So do you think that's a trend that's going to continue? I mean, we've seen a lot of these partnerships in the past. That trend had kind of gone away a little bit, but now there's a potential for big catalogs like Universal's to play a part into offering something that is interesting for corporations to implement.
You asking me?
Yeah.
I think that I think there's two trends there that are both on the upswing. One is people playing with new kinds of alliances. So people who didn't used to necessarily team up together, teaming up to figure out if they can, if this will be the magic combination that is successful.
Yeah.
So I think that's on the upswing, and it may be Universal and HP and Microsoft one week, and next week it may be some other set of players that you didn't used to see working together that way.
Absolutely.
And which ones are going to work out in the long run, like everything right now, I think is very much in flux. The other point in that is about participation, so the being able to win things and whatnot. And I think certainly my work has shown, and an awful lot of other work and a lot of experience out there has shown, that audiences are more and more participatory. You know, there's a huge sector that wants to just listen or just watch, but the sector that wants to participate and be engaged and be doing things is big and growing and is its own phenomenon on a huge scale. So trying to figure out ways to engage that is going to be critical, I think, for music services.
Yeah, because aim of right now, like any streaming service and any sort of real life experience is very much separated. So, you know, the live industry and all the recorded side, which includes all the streaming services, they don't really have any points of contact. So it's although it's a limited experience, because of course it's just a Universal catalog and it's for a limited amount of time. You know, it's interesting to see people trying to bring those two things together and see if there's a connection there.
I think it's interesting, but maybe I'm being massively cynical here, but it reminds me of the dark days of MusicNet and PressPlay, when you had these rival services that wouldn't cross license. You had these partial offerings that were trying to net a mass audience who don't care. Generally, most people don't care what record company, or don't even know what record company people are signed to, and it becomes irrelevant at the point of consumption. Yeah. So while this is good for Universal to be out there doing deals and getting its orders in front of people, I think there is a negative side for the industry as a whole, because I think the industry should be collectively moving towards all of these things. I think certainly in the last 10 years, the industry's, the recorder industry has taken a bit of a beating.
Yeah.
So I think there should be, at this point of crisis, there should be kind of a more sense of unity, and they should be working collectively on all of these services. And yes, some labels have reasons for not licensing to Spotify or not licensing to iTunes, and that becomes a personal thing. But if you've got the four biggest, well, now three biggest record companies in the world, and certain ones are being locked out, I think it's the consumer that ends up suffering, because they're only getting a partial service. You can see that with something like Vivo as well, because Warner Music still hasn't licensed to Vivo. So there, you've lost, 15% of the market straight away. And I don't know if that's because Vivo's a joint venture between Sony and Universal, and Warner were excluded from those talks, or if they had some reason to fall out with the labels over that service. But I think the consumer will start looking for, I don't know, Madonna catalog or Green Day or Neil Young, and that stuff's not going to be there. So that, I think that's going to damage the service, because they'll see it as partial.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I wanted to move on to talking about the idea of, it's something that is sort of a running theme for the past few years, the idea of scarcity. And there was an interesting article by Mark Mulligan on Music Industry Blog talking about pledge music and the way that Janet Devlin, who was an X Factor contestant, kind of managed to relaunch her career a bit, like by offering different types of bundles. This is not a new idea, but the idea that we are recreating scarcity from a place where there's no scarcity in the consumption of music is interesting. Of course, we all know about the Amanda Palmer case with Kickstarter and how much she managed to raise with that campaign. And there's a number of artists that are trying to offer something that is unique and makes people feel special about the purchase that they do and makes them feel connected with the artist. Rihanna is just is releasing a £150 plus box set of her album with all sorts of special things inside that people can latch onto. So Nancy, of course, this is like a big area of expertise for you in terms of like the way people connect to artists and the way the fans behave. Do you think that's a trend that's bound to continue? And how can an artist that is bigger, you know, somebody like, you know, say U2 or Red Hot Chili Peppers, take advantage of the same system? With it being so time consuming in terms of, you know, the way that you have to dedicate a lot of time in creating all these special bundles and delivering them?
I think there are experts out there who can help you do that. I don't think you have to do it all yourself. Yeah. For one thing,
I meant like in terms of a lot of these bands are offering, you know, Skype chats and hangouts and actually personal engagements with fans.
That kind of stuff that can be very, very consuming. I think you have to find the right balance for the right artists, you know, and not all artists think that it's going to be to their audience's benefit to spend half an hour Skyping with them. Yeah. They might think, you know, that's going to demystify music a bit and it's not going to mean as much to them after they've hung out on Skype for half an hour.
Yeah.
So I think that it's a question of finding the right balance and the right ways to let audiences participate for the right artists. I think I was talking to somebody from Kickstarter last week, and we were talking about the problem with something like Kickstarter, where people end up with these huge collections of T-shirts and posters and baseball hats and all these objects, that these scarce objects that they've gotten for participating, and they don't actually want the stuff, you know, and she was saying that she prefers that people offer, lossless downloads or images that you can download in high resolution, and that one keeps to ephemeral deliverables. So I think engagement, that kind of one-on-one engagement for the right artists, it's great, but it's not for everybody. And I don't think it's always a good idea to think that your own time spent one-on-one with somebody is the best scarcity you can deliver.
Yeah.
And that said, backstage passes might be a very different situation with those same artists, right?
Sure.
I'm totally comfortable with that, but half an hour Skyping.
Yeah, and from your experience, you know, do you think fans have changed the way that they want their relationship with the artist to be over, you know, the course of the last 10 years with the rise of digital media?
I think it's really interesting. I think that fans have gone from being beyond thrilled if they got a response to sort of feeling snubbed if they don't get a response.
Yeah.
And then the boundaries around how long does that response go on are getting very blurry. I think there's a lot more people now who sort of expect to be able to have an ongoing interaction. And at the same time, there's a lot of... there's a lot of artists who are thrilled to have that. You know, they're delighted that they can have ongoing interactions with their audience members and build relationships and have friendships. And for them, that's a way more important conversation than the one we were having earlier around Spotify and streaming revenues and all of that, because they're much more interested in this relationship building. And they figure the money will come from that. You know, we don't have to focus on money. We can focus on this relationship building. And isn't it great? So Yeah, it depends.
Yeah, and Eamon, how do you see like Kickstarter? You know, that they're launching. I don't know if they've launched yet in the UK.
They've either just opened or just about to open.
Yeah, it's about to open. Yeah, how do you see that market expanding for us in the UK as well?
I think you will see more acts like this. I think it's interesting that most of the acts do not have some kind of profile, be it Amanda Palmer, who obviously through Roadrunner had a certain level of fame through that. Janet Devlin, obviously being one of the finalists of the X Factor, and bands who've been dropped and things like that. So I've interviewed various artists about why they do this, and they find it enormously time consuming because of course you've got to come up with ideas. So yeah, it's a Skype chat, or you take them out for dinner, or you go and play golf with them, or you play a living room gig, or all of these things. And maybe I'm too old to be excited about this, but I would rather my favourite artists just spend time being brilliant and write brilliant songs and playing brilliant gigs rather than filling out admin forms and checking off lists and things like that. Yeah, it's a thrill for fans, but if that's going to lead to a decline in quality, because they give up full-time jobs and having to kind of live hand-to-mouth so that they could spend time on their art, and rather they spend time on their art. And they obviously, they have a manager traditionally who dealt with all the business side of things. And I think that boundary is now being blurred, where artists are expected to be their own business affairs managers and things like that.
But
that's good, and that's part of the DIY revolution, and it's fantastic because you can go through kind of cut through the previous gatekeepers in most cases, the major labels or the big independents. I think that comes at a cost as well, so I think them spending their time doing these things is interesting, but if they're writing terrible albums as a result of not having much time to write better albums, I think we should pull the brakes on things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's an idea of ownership as well that has shifted over the last few years, especially if these platforms keep thriving the way they are, in the way that the fans feel an ownership towards the end product or towards the output of the artist, as opposed to before when they were just, you know, purchasing the music or listening to the music and then buying a ticket to a gig. And that was still like a fairly disconnected experience for them. You know, they didn't feel like the artist owed them a great deal. Whilst now there's a shift where the audience really feels like the artist owes them their, you know, livelihood, if, you know, the main way that they funded their recording or their tour is via one of these sites, so that there's a lot more accountability that comes into that.
Yeah, because the fan kind of becomes an investor, and they feel that they've contributed rather than buying an album after the fact, i.e. after all the investment's gone in. They're helping do it before, and certain acts really enjoy doing that. Marillion are an obvious example of been doing that for what, nearly 15 years. They really kind of pioneered all of that, and this is in the kind of pre-broadband era as well, so I think that's quite revolutionary. But I think there still should be a bit of a kind of artist fan divide in a way, because I'm reminded of a interview with Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys, and he was talking about there was this kind of sense of artists putting out demos on Facebook or linking to them on Twitter and saying to the fans, which do you think should be the next single? And he said that my job is not to go around asking fans what they think the next single should be or what the next sign for the album should be. That's my job as an artist. I should be doing that.
Yeah.
So I think that if you've got enough faith in your own art, then you don't necessarily need to do that. But I understand why there's a whole kind of middle class of artists who they don't have the luxury of years of hits where they're Mick Jagger or Paul McCartney, and they don't need to do it for the money. There's a lot of people there who have to keep this machine going simply to pay the rent or put food on their tables or whatever. They're not living ostentatious lifestyles, and this becomes part of the deal where, I don't know, it's not quite panhandling, but I feel there can be something a bit kind of sad and a bit grubby about it at times as well. Yeah. If they're and innovative and fun that kind of chimes with their art, and there's creativity put into these extra offerings, then I think that's a good thing. But if it's just ticking off a checklist of you get great backstage or things like that, it reminds me it's Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek from the Doors. They have this bit when they play, obviously they can't play under the name The Doors, but when they play, they have a kind of VIP ticket, and I think you pay like an extra $200 to meet them for 5 minutes backstage. That seems quite crass, really. Yeah. So I go to that extreme. I don't feel like prostituting themselves in a way.
Nancy, what do you feel about like the ownership factor of the fans towards the artists changing over?
I think that when fans fund, they feel more invested. I don't think they think they own, and I don't think that they feel that their funding entitles them to a say in the creative process.
Yeah.
I think that almost every artist will tell you that it's their job to write the songs, not the audiences. Some will tell you, I gave them all 14 tracks. I asked which they thought were the strongest, and they agreed with me.
Yeah.
So they sometimes will feel like, hey, I want them to enjoy it. So, you know, I'll let them sequence it or pick the 10 best or whatever. But I think every artist will tell you that they want to be the ones writing their music. And I think that 99.9% of fans will tell you they don't want to crowdsource the writing of the music. You know, we understand, fans understand that the artists are the ones who write the songs, and that's why we like it.
Yeah.
So I don't think that that's a, I think the trade-offs are, there are absolutely trade-offs, but I think they're much, much subtler, and that there are huge variety of ways that people can be given opportunities to participate that feel more or less like prostituting yourself to different kinds of people. And what to one person feels like prostituting yourself to another might feel like great engagement. And you mentioned Marillion, and Marillion pulled back from fan funding for just that reason. And they said, It feels cheeky to keep going back asking for money when we've got the money. And the fans were ticked off. They wanted that accountability. And it wasn't that they wanted to direct the creative process. It was that they wanted to know what was going on during the recording and to know how it was proceeding. So there's a lot of ways to provide windows into the creative process. I think the whole issue around how much time does the artist have to spend actually doing this is an enormous issue. The roles are shifting dramatically, and I think musicians are, in fact, like almost everybody else in contemporary Western economies, where more and more of the workload gets shifted down onto us, you know, and we're doing more than needs to do, regardless of what our job is. And I think this is absolutely true of musicians, and I think that we know very little, in fact, about, in fact, how do these things actually lead to revenue? Do they lead to revenue? What are the mechanisms through which doing something like letting 50 people hang out with you leads to any kind of sustained economic anything financially? Yeah. There's a lot of faith involved here that it reaching out and participating somehow, or putting stuff on mobile phones, or putting things on Spotify, or taking things off Spotify, or there's a lot of blind faith or good guesses or reasoned decisions, but there's very little real evidence of how any of these things play out in the long run for who and where the money really is in these matters.
Yeah. And I
necessarily have to do the stuff if they're really uncomfortable with it. I'm not convinced that's the only way to engage audiences and do that kind of that kind of relationship.
Absolutely. And we can look at the other side of the coin. So there was an article on Music Ally by Stuart Dredge. You can find all the article links in the show notes as well for the audience that is listening, that reported the latest numbers for 2011 in terms of marketing investment by record labels and A&R investment as well. So the marketing investment has been $4.5 billion for 2011. By record companies, of which $2.7 billion was spent in A&R. So this is really an interesting window on putting in perspective the funded side with the big muscle record label side, because there's still a huge divide. I would be interested to see like some numbers put together as to what is the value of all the fund-funded campaigns that have happened in the past in year, and compare that to these kind of numbers. And I think, you know, that would be
Kickstarter in the last 2 years has funded, I believe, 8,900 music projects for $55 million. So it's
okay. So we can see, you know, it's a tiny proportion of the A&R spend that the record labels are doing. And I think the record labels know that because in face of, I think it was something like 16-17% drop since 2008, that the actual drop in the investment in A&R has only been like of like 3 or 4 percentage points or something like that.
I think there's an interesting point in that, though, that which has to be measured out, which is that while label revenues have gone down and investments kind of stayed relatively stable over the last 3 or 4 years, labels are investing in more sets of rights as they push through 360 deals. Okay. So you would hope that that level of investment is going up because they're going to get a cut of publishing or merchandise or live or endorsements and all of those things that traditionally they didn't get involved in. And that also affects the types of artists that they're signing as well, because I know that Warner's has a very, very firm policy of, I don't know, maybe that's been relaxed under its new Russian owners, but certainly when it was under Edgar Bronfman, they had a 360 deal or nothing. And Universal, I think pretty much every act it signed in the last couple of years has been multiple rights deals, so it's been 270 and up, and I think most of them are 360 deals. So you would hope that the level of investment would go up because the revenue streams are or greater. Although when I put that question to Max Hall of Universal International on Monday at the IPI press conference, he claimed that the money coming in from 360 deals from non-recorded was minuscule, but I think this is going to be a long play, so that in 5 years they will see a dramatic difference. But if you've got a 360 deal with hypothetically Robbie Williams, and Robbie Williams goes on tour, you're very quickly going to make more money from his live shows than you will from Spotify streams, iTunes downloads, CD sales. And I think that was certainly the case with his first 360 deal with EMI back in 2002. I kind of heard people at EMI suggesting that within a couple of shows, they'd got their investment back very, very quickly. That tour worked out very, very well for everybody involved. So it depends how active the artist is. If you've got a 360 deal and the artist is just putting out records during that particular period, then your return's not going to be great. But if they're out and they're actually touring and selling merchandise and all of those things, then that investment level that they've kind of held steady will start to make proper sense, because you're suddenly all these huge revenue streams that previously you were locked out of have suddenly been opened up to you, and you get a share of that.
Yeah, and Nancy, the role of A&R has changed a lot as well in the last 10, 15 years, just because of the way that bands end up being signed now. So although the investments stay the same, there are certain elements that are compulsory for a band to be able to get under the radar of an A&R person. And the fan base is a key part of that radar. So if there's no fan base, if there's no buzz to the band, it's almost impossible for a band to get any traction. You know, a band has to be pretty mature nowadays in their process and in the way that they've developed the music to actually attract the interest of a record label. Do you think that's changed the way that the bands also structure their careers at the beginning? Because, you know, they know that they have to have at least a couple of EPs or even a full length album before they can even hope for the most part to get a deal with a label.
I guess I would question how many bands are actually starting with the premise of getting signed by a label and being the next Robbie Williams with a 360 deal. I think that now, as always, it's a small subset of people who want to play music who are really, you know, aiming for stardom. I think it's true that a lot of bands who would like to do it professionally would like to get a label, but I think that you know, I mean, I can't really speak to how most bands are planning. My sense is that most bands aren't really planning. They're trying to pay rent and things like that, and trying to make decent music, and they're trying to figure out what the best strategy is in a time when it's very difficult to know what the best strategy is. And anybody who tells you that what you have to do is this, this, and this is making it up, you know. So they're trying a bit of everything, and I think that young bands feel you know, crushed under the burden of having to manage their own careers and having to figure everything out from the start. But that said, I think that, you know, if I think back 30 years ago, and the bands that you knew then, you know, hardly any of them even ever figured they'd have any shot at more local audience. So
absolutely,
brain has shifted, and now everybody's got a shot at it, but you have to work a lot harder to even be a local band now.
Yeah, exactly. I can give you some numbers, actually, though. In the same article, talks about the fact that the IFPI hailed the results of a survey whereby 301 unsigned bands in the UK, of 301 unsigned bands in the UK, 71% said that they aim to be signed by a record company. I mean, that's an interesting figure, but you also have to take into account that it's, you know, these numbers were hailed by the FBI, so I'm not sure what the context of the survey was. Of course, that plays into their interest of wanting...
unsigned bands. Who was that? Where did they go to get a list of unsigned bands to randomly sample?
Yeah, exactly. So that's
They're not going to publish figures where it said only 1% of bands that we spoke to want a deal. They're not going to... Those kind of figures aren't going to be published. Of course, well, it also depends on what way the question was phrased as well. Yeah. But I think the fundamental point is that labels, even within the music industry ecosystem, it's still labels are the primary investors in new music. Yeah, they buy that drum repeatedly, but I think they've got much justification to do that. Even sometimes you might get a development deal from a publisher or something like that. But I worked on a report a couple of years ago with Tony Wadsworth of X of EMI, and the figure that we find when we were speaking to lawyers and managers and stuff like that, that there's a cutoff point of investment for them of £50,000 in an artist, then they would start to look to somebody else. So it's, if you want serious investment in your career, you are going to go to a record label, and that can be an independent, because obviously big independents like Ministry of Sound or Beggars Group or Domino have got the budgets to do that, and that's why they develop big acts. But yeah, I think you can get to a certain point with minimal investment, and certainly the tools out there to do things and build up a buzz are quite cheap, and in many cases free for bands, so they can get to a certain level with minimal investment. In a way that previously didn't. But obviously, I guess the biggest cost and the bit that still hasn't gone down is the live side of things. So that bit of traveling overnight in the back of a van to play to two people in a bar when you're third on the bill, and you have to go through that grind for a year and a half. The cost of petrol is going up, all of these things. While lots of tools are making it easier for bands and cheaper for bands, the main bit where that you kind of build a buzz and build a following is costing incrementally more for artists.
Yeah. Sure. And in the same survey, it was talking about how now to break an act, it costs about $1.4 million. That was in 2011. So that was an average to break an artist in a major market. So that gives you like a little bit, I mean, it's a you know, pie in the sky figure a little bit, just because I'm sure the costs vary wildly from artist to artist and from how the campaign goes and what kind of awards they get or anything like that. I'm sure Alt J that just won the Mercury's have probably spent $1.4 million
to get $4.
Yeah, to get where they are. So that varies wildly from artist to artist. But it's interesting to see that figure, just because you compared that to the $1 million that Amanda Palmer managed to raise. And she's the only one that's managed to do that so far on a crowdfunded level. And you see how hard it is to match that type of investment from a fan-funded environment and bring that to the mainstream, because I think she managed to get a top 10 album on the Billboard or something like that, and that's an achievement, of course, but she's got a huge background also with major labels, and she's got a huge fan base. But for anybody else to try and do the same thing without the support of a label, that would be pretty much almost impossible. I mean,
From that IFPI figure, one of the most interesting sub-points about that 1.4 million was how much money's being spent on promo videos. That was kind of between a third and half a million, which in this day and age, to spend that sort of money on a promo, it's just ridiculous.
The budget was absurd.
Yeah.
Why do you need that? People, it's not like you're getting a big showcase on MTV or on TV anymore. Videos are being watched on YouTube. They're being watched on mobile phones. You don't need to spend that sort of money on a video, I think. So I think it's ridiculous that the budget is skewed so strongly towards things like that.
Yeah.
And so strongly towards so few. I mean, when we're talking, how many people are going to be stars at any given moment, and how many people are making music in the world and trying to make a living at making music? I just think it's, to some extent, it's, I recognize the economics of scale, but to some extent, it's absurd to be talking about the 30 people at the top of the pie as though that's the music industry, when we have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people making music professionally and making livings making music and finding ways of doing it. And to my mind, that's what we need to be focused on understanding. You know, that's where the future is.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think I'm going to go towards the wrap here. It was great having you on. So first of all, I just wanted to ask you, you know, is there anything you would like to plug or anything that you've been working on that you'd like to mention? Eamon?
Oh, goodness me. I'm very terrible at self-promotion. What am I doing? I'm writing a feature for the issue of Q at the end of the year on musicals. There's a whole big industry that people don't talk about, but in the UK last year, the West End, I think it was worth, the West End sector was worth 500 million, something like that, in revenues, but musicals were generating about 370 million of that. So it's this quiet part of the industry that people don't care about. So it's like things like We Will Rock You and Mamma Mia. These were phenomenally successful things. I've spoken to head of business affairs at Universal, Adam Spiegel, who was a producer, did like Hairspray and Grease and things like that. And Phil McIntyre, who kind of nearly lost his entire livelihood back in We Will Rock You because it was an absolute disaster when and they had to change it during the first 6 months. So, I'm writing about musical theatre, which is a thing that I've learned an incredible amount about in the last couple of weeks.
Okay, that's awesome. And are you going to see any shows, just to get some perspective?
Yes, I am. I am going out tonight to see Lady Huck, who has produced one of my three favourite albums of the year, and the other two being Django Django and Sharon Van Etten. So I'm very excited to see Lady Huck tonight.
Awesome. Very nice. And Nancy, anything your end?
I have a couple of pretty readable pieces coming out pretty soon. One is going to be in an online journal called Participations, and it's about the way that the lines between being a fan and being a friend get blurred and how musicians deal with that blurriness. And then I've got a piece coming out about how musicians make sense of Twitter and dealing with Twitter. So I got those two things in the pipeline.
That's great. Well, thanks very much. I'm going to put the links, of course, and your Twitter accounts in the show notes or in the end titles. And it was absolutely great having you on. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.